Coming up on this week's show, the return of Amstrad.
Watch movies on your Atari 2600.
And we chat to the father of internet radio, Carl Malamud.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, brand new and just launched this week, have you seen their latest title? N64, a visual compendium, packed with the most gorgeous screenshots and game art, and celebrating over 150 titles that defined Nintendo's 64-bit wonder. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 419, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And very nice of you joining us for the podcast every single Friday. Of course, a show that takes you back to the classic age of video games. Actually, you know, I do this bit every week. I always set up what the podcast is. I'm going to pick on someone. Joe, explain the show. What is it?
Oh, why are you picking on me? I said, you know what? Before we started recording, I said, don't drop me in it this week, Dan.
Well, that was like a red rag to a bull, that was, Joe.
It really was. What is this podcast? Sometimes people ask me at work, oh, what's your podcast about? It's about retro games. It's about those years that we missed, the years of, you know, nostalgia, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the golden age of gaming. Mm. Not just gaming. Sometimes we dabble, you know, in technology, the internet, radio, video, etc. But yeah, anything retro kind of goes, anything that's older than 15, 20 years. You know, we do a little bit of a news segment, and then we do a little bit of an interview. And yeah, it's usually about... meant to be an hour. It's about an hour and a half long. There you go. That's the retro hour.
The retro hour and a half doesn't flow that well off the tongue, we don't find, so hence the name. But we do get messages all the time, like, for example, at The Rich Voices sent us a tweet during the week, or an X. He said, disappointed to have only just discovered the retro hour, is making up for it by binging the last 418 episodes at the moment. So loving the nostalgia. So I guess he'll hear this probably in about a year or something. But we do get messages like that all the time. So whether you listen every week, you know, since the beginning, or whether you've just found us, we really appreciate you joining us. And we have got an incredible guest on the way in the second half of the podcast. Like you said, you know, we cover gaming and technology as well. This is a bit more of a techie episode. But before we get into that, anyone watch the Brit Awards over the weekend?
No, it's not as controversial as it used to be, is it? I used to watch it for all the madness and anarchy that happens there, but it's quite tame nowadays, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I must admit, I didn't watch much of it. The missus had it on Saturday night, and it's like probably the neffest of all the award shows, isn't it? You watch it mainly to see what goes wrong and the awkward silences and, you know, the cringeworthy stuff from the presenters. But there was one moment that has got kind of the retro world in a bit of a stir this week. And everyone's been sharing this. I've seen it on all my friends' Facebook timelines. People have been tagging me in it. I've seen it in our Discord as well. That Calvin Harris, who is... it might be people who are not familiar with Calvin Harris. He's a world-famous DJ and producer, been around for around 20-odd years now. And Rav, you talked before about the fact that you know that Calvin had his roots on the Amiga, but it turns out backstage at the Brits, there was a little video that he posted on his Instagram feed. Basically him messing around backstage with an Amiga 1200. Have a listen to this.
I've got an Amiga, and I'm making the remix.
So him basically messing around on what sounds like Octomed or something on the Amiga 1200?
Yeah, he's just tracking and playing around with his machine. I think it's quite cool. He's mentioned using the Amiga. He used it on his first album, actually, yeah. But he kind of used it to set the basic layouts of the tracks and then obviously expanded because it was four channels. And, you know, you need a lot more than that for a modern tune, but he was using Optimerge, you know, playing around with it, and I think it's quite cool. It's like we saw those videos of, you know, people with Game Boys linking them up and using them on film sets to play with in a kind of modern context. And I love the idea that, you know, it's a creative device. He's not sitting there playing cannon fodder or lemmings.
Well, you don't know. Maybe between takes he will.
Yeah. Or maybe remixing the tunes from them. But you know, he's actually kind of still producing, but, you know, doing it in his spare time. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the fact that he's got one of his modern songs actually kind of sequencing on the Amiga. You've got Ellie Goulding, the singer, who looks a little bit bewildered, kind of looking at him like, okay. But I did see a post actually straight after that that Steve from Retro Passion, who is kind of one of the UK's premier like recapping services, he sells a lot of retro stuff. Turns out he'd actually recently recapped this Amiga 1200, I think for Sony Music, and he wasn't sure why. And then he kind of put two and two together and like, ah, that's a machine that working on the other week.
Because there's a quote here from Kerwin Harris, and it says... when they asked him about the Amiga, this is years ago from Music Radar, he said, I loved it. It was like playing a computer game, but actually you were making something at the end, and it was kind of creative.
Yeah, which it's incredible to see that, you know, he's got that Amiga setup running and, you know, still kind of using it as well, taking it to a massive music award show. So that was very cool to see. And also, did you see Windows 95 Man, who is at Finland's entry for the Eurovision Song Contest this year?
I'm going to vote for Finland.
This is bizarre. This has just been like, I've seen this everywhere as well over the last couple of days. A guy who is basically wearing a kind of a cut-off kind of crop T-shirt with the Windows 95 logo on.
In the world of, you know, being a radio DJ, Dan, you're going to get like shown all the Eurovision stuff. I honestly hadn't heard of Windows 95, man.
Yeah.
I'm looking at him. He's got like a crop top, yeah.
Yeah.
And cut some off denim hot pants. And then this kind of man made out of pure denim, but like a denim kind of strappy coat. Yeah, I wonder if he's going to have like the Windows theme song in it or like sound effects.
Oh, wow.
From like errors and stuff.
That would be awesome. It's kind of the Windows 95 like sounds throughout his performance. Yeah, I'd vote for that. So it has been a really cool week in terms of, you know, music and award shows and just seeing kind of retro popping up everywhere really kind of proves how out there it is these days. And actually, we mentioned music and you kind of touched on radio there as well, because today we're going to be talking about internet radio. Now, I don't know if you guys remember kind of the first time you listened to internet radio. I've got a feeling, Joe, you still haven't ever listened to radio over the internet in 2024.
You're really dropping me in it this week.
You should give it a go. It's really cool.
You know what was really funny? Dan asked me earlier on, he goes, but don't you listen to the radio? Don't you listen to, you know, we listen to Dan actually quite a bit in his day job when he's on the radio at home. And he was like, how do you do that? And I was like, on the radio, Dan. We just have a radio in the kitchen.
That blew my mind. I was like, you're not going to Alexa or a Google Home or,
No, just like, on the radio in the kitchen.
I was always a radio fanboy, so I kind of listened to early internet radio. There was also this amazing thing called the pirate radio scanner, and I've never seen anything like it. It was a radio scanner, so I think you could control an FM radio, and it would scan through all the pirate stations on London at the time.
Well, like a remote radio then, was it?
Yeah, and then you could actually tune in and like pick them, but it was in real time, and it's really low quality as well, because I remember Real Audio was one of the one of the first kind of you know, experiences I had of listening to internet audio. But also Icecast was another thing where you could set up your own station, and I remember doing that. But all of this is long after our guest this week.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being at college actually and kind of staying late, and they had, I think it was one of the lecturers must have used this like what looked like a really high-end Windows NT PC up in one of the computer labs. And I remember it having like a 22-inch flat screen Trinitron CRT on there, and it had some gorgeous speakers. I remember stopping there late and listening to like, you know, Kiss FM in London, listening to like the garage shows on there, and like this must have been 1998. And
was
then
it still a pirate then? Or?
No, it was legal then, but they had like, you know, the likes of Tuff Jam and people like that on there, which, you know, I love listening to those, and not being able to receive them when I lived in North Yorkshire. That was cool to be able to listen over the internet. You know, I didn't have a good enough internet connection at home then. But also, you reminded me that I did used to do a show on a radio station on the internet. This was in, must have been 98, 99, a station called, I think it was WIDR in Florida. Me and my friend Barry used to do a weekly dance music show on there. But obviously, I mean, back then, we didn't have the skills or the tech to basically record a radio show, digitize it, FTP it over. I didn't know how to do any of that. So the way we used to do it is record like a two-hour show onto a VHS videotape and then stick it in the mail every week and post it over to Florida. So the guy at the other end would digitize it.
That's great. I love that.
So yeah, things have changed quite a bit. But actually, like you said, our guest this week was doing pretty much what we do today over 30 years ago. Now, this is Carl Malamud, who set up the world's first ever internet radio station, and it was called Internet Talk Radio. Now, Carl came onto my radar because I was watching an old episode of the Computer Chronicles from, I think it was 1995, when they were profiling. So, you know, every couple of years, if you've ever watched archives of the Computer Chronicles, I mean, they're on YouTube if you want to check them out. But they'll often do these shows basically profiling the internet, like every couple of years. There's one in like 93, one in 95, one in 98. But there's a very short, like 90-second section in the 95 episode where they show Carl's radio station, and they're talking about how he does this kind of first ever, not only real-time internet broadcasting, but also offered on-demand programming as well. So if you think about, I mean, his flagship show was something called Geek of the Week, and he had the likes of, you know, Tim Berners-Lee on there, who, you know, was the inventor of the World Wide Web. He did an interview with him back in 1993, recorded it, digitized it, uploaded it for people to download and listen to it. So by all, you know, what we know today, by all definitions, that would be a podcast, wouldn't it?
Yeah, in 1993 as well. Yeah. Like, you think about the internet and when it kind of came around, that's such early days. Vince Cerf as well, you know, he was talking with Carl. He had a lot of people on the podcast and, well, on the internet show. And, yeah, I just think it's amazing because I love it when we get these kind of pioneering guests and especially stories from back in the days when, you know, we were talking about multicasting and the fact that, you know, the bandwidth was so small for the entire internet that when somebody would multicast, you know, people would get really angry because all the bandwidth was being used up.
You're slowing my connection down. Get off it. Yeah.
And people would be using like Sun Microsystems and these kind of, you know, workstations to listen to this. And of course, it was aimed at a very techie crowd. Yeah. And, you know, Carl talks us all through the process of how they went about it because it was quite a professional setup, to be honest.
Yeah, he had a proper studio to do it all in, and, you know, he's recording it on their DAT, you know, digital audio tapes, to get the best quality, even though he's uploading them in an 8-bit format onto the internet, because, I mean, you know, file sizes had to be, you know, compared to today, very small then. But you remember, I mean, he started this in late 1992. It was before even, like, MP3 was invented.
Yeah.
And, you know, we think today, you put a podcast out there, you can get it on, you know, phone in your pocket, marketing it, you put it out on social media. We hear about how he actually got the word out and found his guests back in those days, you know, decades before anything like, you know, Facebook or even MySpace or anything like that was invented.
For the limited crowd that had a sound card.
Yeah, exactly. And then also he put on, I mean, he was a big supporter of those early internet days. He put on the world's first internet world exhibition that was basically, you know, an internet world fair. He kind of brought the world fair concept into the digital age, and there's like a time capsule of that as well. So really interesting guest. And you know that particularly I try and do these episodes every now and then, kind of internet history episodes, because you and I get a chance to really geek out about these, Ravi. So you're gonna love this.
We went crazy on this one. Yeah, this is totally my jam.
So a really interesting guest, Carl Malamud, the founder, the father of internet radio, and probably podcasting as well. He's going to be on the show in around 35 minutes from now. But of course, first half of the podcast, that's when we have a little natter about what's been happening in the world of retro over the last 7 days. And it has been another busy, packed week in the retro gaming and tech world, including this headline that has been all over the standard news sites outside of the, you know, the retro sphere, that Alan Sugar has apparently revived Amstrad.
Are you going to start, Joe?
I didn't know.
I'm just waiting for someone to do an Alan Sugar impression. I know you're both pretty good at it. Yeah.
I can't do it. I can't way. Do it.
Just driving, just goes,
I'm a Barra boy.
There you go. But Alan Sugar, I mean, are you watching The Apprentice, Joe? That's kind of what he's most known for these days here in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I am watching The Apprentice at the moment, and all we do is point at it and go, oh, this is terrible, this is so set up, oh, kind of thing. But yeah, Alan Sugar, interesting guy. So he has just, inverted commas, revived Amstrad. So he famously founded Amstrad in 1968, was it?
Do you know what it stood for?
Alan Michael Sugar Trading.
Definitely didn't read that, did you? You knew that by heart.
I read it yesterday.
Good memory, Joe.
I read it yesterday.
Yeah, but obviously they were, you know, in terms of British computing, they were, you know, a big player back in the day. And also there's quite a few on the continent as well. I remember, because I think, wasn't Amstrad an Amstrad PC your first computer, Ravi?
Yeah, it was actually. There was like that huge market of PC clones that came out. And I think they also did like sound systems and stuff like that.
Yeah, high fives.
It was kind of all in one concept, wasn't it, with Amstrad?
Yeah, and it was, you know, a really big play. I remember my auntie having one of the Amstrad, you know, the PCWs, I think they were the little word processors, which were a very big market for Amstrad back in the day. But the thing that they really kind of found their fortune in was making set-top boxes for Sky, which is the major satellite company.
Which is an interesting path because, you know, obviously you had a lot of companies like Amiga at the time and stuff, and it kind of failed and they didn't go into anything. Where the Amstrad name lived on. I do remember seeing those kind of sky boxes with Amstrad on the back and being like, oh, you know, a bit of nostalgia there. And of course, there was the whole connection with Sinclair as well.
Yeah.
You see, I didn't know that they went into the sky box, you know, making them, and then that Sky bought them. I just assumed Amstrad fizzled out, you know, it just died, you know, and obviously because he's, you know, multi-billionaire or whatever he is now, he just had his fingers in lots of other pies, if you will. I didn't realise, you know, that he actually sold it. He sold it in like 2007 to Sky, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he sold it for $125 million. I think the reason was, you know, they were basically paying royalties and licences every year to Amstrad, and Sky completely relied on that, you know, or Be Sky B, as it were known then. So they were basically like, look, we'll just buy the whole company. We'll buy the name. So that saved them licensing it. But yeah, they did do some of the weird like kind of products that maybe some people have forgotten. Like we were talking about the Amstrad Emailer, which were these kind of, you could almost call them, I guess, desktop smartphones in a way.
Yeah, they had like video calling and stuff. And I remember they were used by old people quite a lot. But they also had Spectrum games on them, which was pretty cool.
Well, obviously Amstrad bought Sinclair back in the 80s. Which is interesting because basically what's happened now is Alan Sugar has bought back the name of Amstrad from Sky. Because, I mean, it doesn't seem like today that Sky are kind of doing anything with it. You don't see the Amstrad logo or name anywhere. But apparently it's not going to be the Amstrad that we knew. It's not going to be, you know, slapped on any new computers or tablets or anything like that. Apparently it's going to be a digital marketing agency that's going to be run by his grandson. So it turns out, you know, he's bought the name back. His grandson's going to take up the Amstrad legacy. But the question that a lot of people in the retro world have been asking is, does that mean that he's kind of got the rights to Sinclair and the Spectrum back now? And what does that kind of mean for stuff like, you know, the Spectrum Next, for example? I've seen a few people a little bit worried that it might affect that. I can't imagine that they're linked in any way anymore, though, because obviously all Alan's done is to buy back the Amstrad name. So I don't think they'd come as like a package bundle. I imagine when Sky took over Amstrad, they basically acquired everything. And now, you know, the Sinclair name and the Spectrum trademarks, all that kind of thing is just part of Sky's portfolio. And Alan Sugar's literally just bought back the Amstrad part of that. So I can't see it affecting the Spectrum Next or anything like that.
Well, also it kind of says online and digital. I'm thinking maybe they'll expand out into, you know, Amstrad nostalgic style clothes that they have in like H&M and stuff. You know, you get Polaroid. I've seen Polaroid absolutely everywhere, and these older brands. But also, if he is doing digital, getting into that sphere of going online, he's going to get absolutely hammered by Amstrad fans, of course, and then probably think, oh, there might be a potential here to, you know, do something with it and see that as a way of getting revenue.
Well, if you are a viewer of The Apprentice, I mean, he's not shy about talking about his past. And I think, wasn't it last year, Joe, if you watched it, there was an episode where they do like a treasure hunt, don't they, where he sends them out into certain places and they get like a list of items they've got to bring back. And I remember one of them was an Amstrad CPC computer. I don't know if you remember that episode. I think it was about a year ago, maybe a year before.
Oh, I don't remember it.
I mean, and often if you follow him on Twitter, occasionally he just do posts about, like, you know, or retweets about the Amstrad CPC.
Didn't he mention that he was going to open like an Amstrad museum a few years ago as well?
He did, yeah. And I mean, a lot of the press pictures of this article, you know, that seemed basically the PR agency sent out to a lot of the media, there are pictures of like Alan Sugar now with a lot of old Amstrad PCs and CPCs and stuff like that. So it seems like, you know, they're kind of using the computer angle of it for the nostalgia to get the headlines. So,
you know,
maybe
I'd love to see a TV series of that. Like the BBC could do it. And like, you know, I love Microman and stuff and I thought that was good, but the Alan Sugar story, you know, themed in a Del Boy style. Would be, yeah. Well, good.
And we could present it in green screen like you're watching it on an Amstrad CPC monitor.
Yeah, Rodney could present it.
Pictures are available now if Netflix want to get in touch, Ravi. I'm sure you'll sell on the idea, yeah. Develop it with them. So Amstrad is back. It's interesting to see what will happen. We'll keep an eye on that. Now, another interesting story that has caught our eye this week is watching movies on your Atari 2600. Now, as soon as I saw this, I thought, what, is this for like the modern Atari 2600 Plus? Has someone hacked it or something? But no, this is the original 1977 Atari 2600 console.
Have you watched the video of it, like the quality?
Yes. It's mind-blowing for what it's running on. I don't know if it's going to replace watching Ultra Blu-ray 4K discs on my 65-inch
TV. I mean,
telly.
I don't know about you guys, but I've just watched Dune 2 on it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Don't ask how I've done it. Nah, jokes aside. So, yeah, this is the movie cart, which has been made by a guy called Low Def Mode. Mm. And he's developed this cartridge that allows your original 2600, so like you say, it is the OG Atari 2600, essentially... Yeah, play films. Am I right in thinking so? I don't really get my head around. I can't really get my head around.
So I'm usually quite technical on these things, and I cannot understand this at all. I don't know how it works, to be honest. Ask me, Joe, and I'll try to bang something together.
I think I've got my head around this because
it seems like magic.
Well, this is basically, it's a cartridge.
I'd love it if Dan just went, it's magic.
Yeah. Basically, you wave a magic wand, it appears on the screen. That's how it works. This is a cartridge he's released called the Movie Cart. So yeah. What this is, it's a little circuit board. Looks like a custom design that you
plug
into.
Has it got like a little processor on there or a microcontroller or something?
Yeah.
I assume it's got some modern hardware in there that you wouldn't be able to get back in the days and... have on a cart and do this.
Yeah, this wouldn't have been possible 40 years ago. But there's basically, it comes in a, you know, what looks like a standard Atari 2600 cartridge. There is a little hole at the top where you can put an SD card in. And what you've got to do is you're basically going to get the movie onto your PC or your Mac, and then using some software, you then basically down-res the movie to a resolution of 80 by 192. And as you can see, the colour palette isn't all that rich on here as well. But basically, it translates it into a format that then you can stream, essentially, using this cartridge to the Atari 2600.
So that's what I thought. I thought the cart must be doing some kind of processing there or, you know, handling the load on there, because there's no way that that can run on the original hardware unless it is just magic, you know, without the cart. But, just seeing that, it's pretty amazing, to be honest.
Yeah, we've seen stuff like this before, like on the Commodore 64. You know, there's the 1541 Ultimate, I think it was. I remember seeing the guys from the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester who were displaying this at the Cambridge Computer Museum.
Kind of blasting movies down it as well. But I would have expected, like, you know, a Raspberry Pi or something to be kind of repurposed. But this seems like it's a custom board. And it's not that badly priced as well. You know, $24.99, basically.
Yeah, he was selling these, you know, $24.99. That was a fully assembled PCB board with an SD card as well, apparently, and labels. So I think that was a bargain. They were selling those on a website called Tindy.
It's got Night of the Living Dead preloaded on it as well.
Yeah, which I don't know about the legality of that. That does sound a little bit iffy, but
there's a whole story there. Night of the Living Dead is in public domain.
Right, so okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yes, I looked at that and I was like, yeah, that's interesting. Even if it wasn't, I can't imagine any movie studio, like you said, looking at this thinking, well, no one's going to go to the cinema now if they can just watch it on the
Honestly, I can't imagine anybody sitting down saying, I'm going to watch this, because the quality of it is, it's pretty tough. But I think also all the captures that we've seen have been on a flat screen TV. Maybe it'll look a bit nicer on a CRT.
That is a good point, yeah, it could. And it looks like there's some basic controls, like you can change the brightness if you watch his YouTube video. It turns out the videos I've seen of this, it's basically him filming a flat screen TV, like using his phone. There doesn't appear to be any kind of direct video capture, so he's probably not the best.
There's a few on Atari Age, like Fred on Atari Age. I tried to understand it and... Mm. It's pages of like stuff that's far beyond over.
Sounds like Atari Age. But talking about the quality of it, I'd kind of say it looks like a 40-year-old VHS tape that's maybe been left in a damp attic with playing back on a video player with bad tracking.
And scan lines digitally cut in, yeah.
It is a bit flickery, but I think, you know, you've got to remember what this is running on. We talk about
this
all the time.
Amazing that it's in a little format as well. You know, something like this, I'd expect to see wires hanging out, you know, all kind of madness from stuff that you usually see on Hackaday. But it's really clean and well done.
Yeah, and you look at the size of it as well. I mean, obviously, he's kind of viewing this on a widescreen modern TV. So I imagine kind of there'd be borders at the side of it if you're looking at this as like a 4:3 display. But actually, I'd say in terms of the video, it looks a lot bigger than something like the movies that you would have got on a Sega Mega CD back in the day, or, you know, something like the CD TV or the CD32. I think in terms of the actual size of the video, it's almost full screen.
It says it's got audio present as well, and the audio can be controlled via the joystick, like the volume of it. And that's another amazing feat, having audio coming through there as well as video, you know, lo-fi quality, they're saying.
I love this as well, because you're like, then, you know, who on earth is going to do this? But then bear in mind, Ravi, didn't you just like pay out quite a bit of money for a system to let you watch video CDs on your Amiga 4000?
Shush, don't tell anyone. Yeah, there
we
go.
We are geeks if there's a way to do it, and it's fun. It's a bit of novelty, so that, you know, I think it's very cool. And like you said, for $24.99, it turns out they're sold out at the moment, but hopefully those pre-orders will come back. If you want a nice little novelty, show your friends you're watching movies on your Atari 2600 and blow their mind, I will link that up as well. There's a little waiting list option on there, so if you want to be alerted when they're back on sale, I'll put that in this week's show notes as well. Now, this looks right up my street. As someone who loved games like Desert Strike back in the day and Z-Wolf on the Amiga, I love a good kind of helicopter shoot 'em up 3D kind of sim. And this is a new game called Thunder Helix that takes inspiration from a lot of those classics like the Strike games.
I think this looks wicked. Mm. It's to me, it feels like Desert Strike meets Star Fox for the Super Nintendo.
Graphically, like
graphically, the look of it. So this has been developed by one developer, David Walters, and it's coming out on Steam. It just says in the future, so it's just coming out soon, essentially. But there is a 35-minute gameplay video out as well as a trailer. But yeah, it's a, you know, it's very much in the vein of, so think graphically Star Fox, so those polygon graphics and, you know, quite a base, not basic color palette, but, you know, it's a very bright game, isn't it? But there's not many different colours, etc. But
and,
I love
and
the
I guess
look of
it's
it.
I guess it's the setting as well, you know, like
desert
dry, you're in a desert.
Desert sort out of the ocean.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then gameplay wise, it is closer to the Strike games, you know, a little bit more open world, and you can fly around, you know, blowing up the baddies and rescuing hostages and stuff like that. But yeah, I saw this and spotted it, and I thought of you right away, Dan. I thought this is very like, obviously it's coming out on Steam, so it's not coming out on any retro consoles or anything like that, you know, and it is going to be joystick compatible as well as, you know, Xbox controller compatible and stuff like that. So very old school with the joystick as well, what I love. But it reminded me very much of a very good looking Amiga game as well.
Well, I know Dan's going to say Z-Wolf straight away, but it also reminds me of 3D Construction Kit, which was another one. Like, all the elements seem like that they were built in that way, with the kind of shading, like Castle Master as well. But of course, you've got all the benefits of it being a modern title. So, you know, it's got nice frame rate.
Yeah.
The effects are smooth and stuff like that. There's a section with these oil tankers and stuff and smoke going up, and that looks really impressive.
And I kind of feel like there's been, you know, there's not been many of these kind of games made over the last couple of decades that I've seen.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you there. You know, you get like World of Tanks and stuff like that. But I'm just off the top of my head trying to think of like any helicopter sim games where it's not just like Flight Simulator, where an actual game where, because, you know, it used to be a whole genre of like Ace Combat and, you know,
and it was weird
games,
kind of
say.
Like, I don't know, maybe the Amiga version didn't have music, but the desolate kind of flying around a desert in a helicopter and all you can hear is vroom, 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 and then like picking up oil crates and the whole idea about fuel and stuff like that.
And the little guys, over here!
Yeah, over here.
Your little crane, your little thing that used to come out the bottom of your helicopter.
I miss that kind of act. You know, that kind of era of gaming. And like, yeah, that was like a world that we were all trapped in at some point.
It really was.
Desperate for fuel in the desert. Like,
yeah, I love those games. And it is something that I've, you know, I do regularly go back and play Desert Strike and Z-Wolf 2, which I don't know if you played Z-Wolf before or even seen it, Joe. It's basically like it looks a bit more like this, a game that plays like Desert Strike, but it's kind of rudimentary 3D graphics. Very slowly on my Amiga back in the day, but like on a, you know, more souped up moderner Amiga, it works a lot better. So I think I've always been a big fan of these kind of games. And even looking at this, like the screenshots of, you know, the helicopter landing on the Frygate out in the middle of the sea, very much like Desert Strike started and having to return there.
I looked at it and there's got Z-Wolf style in there, but also there's some of the people that look like, you know, Hunter, which was another one. It looks like one of the guys off Hunter, the little characters in there as well. So I think it's pulling nostalgia from everywhere.
I hope there's some really over-the-top weapons in it. Like, do you remember the Hellfires that you get in Desert Strike? I remember I had a cheat code where you got like basically infinite ammo. And I just use them to, like, you know, massive missiles just to shoot any little tiny enemy on the screen. You felt really powerful doing that. So that was quite a laugh. So
I like chasing cars. That was good.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, it was just a great genre. So I welcome it back. Like you said, only available on PC, pre-order on Steam at the moment. I think something like this would be awesome to play on the Switch. And I'll say that about kind of pretty much every kind of retro game that we talk about. But hopefully it'll be a success enough for them to consider porting it to other systems as well. As someone who's not much of a PC gamer, but, you know, I'll definitely get back on my Steam account for this, I think. So no word on release yet or pricing, but if you want to check out the trailers, I'll link those in the show notes as well. Now, this is pretty exciting. Now, I think, you know, we can all bow to Jeff Minter. We do generally talk about him quite a bit, as being one of the best British developers of the last 40 years. And everyone loves Jeff Minter, don't they? Everyone you talk to, not only his games, but also Jeff as a character as well. I mean, we've had the pleasure of meeting him at several retro events over the years. He was in our book, wasn't he, that we did last year as well. Just an all-round lovely guy.
And the world's kind of changed and Jeff stayed the same and that's actually, you know, done him really well. And his style's changed the same, but it's evolved as well. And it's a fantastic kind of story of an independent developer.
Yeah, well, the reason we're talking about this is because there is a new, it is kind of an interactive documentary. And we've seen a few of these before. There's obviously this is by Digital Eclipse, who did the massive Atari 50 collection a couple of years ago. They also did the Jordan Mechner Prince of Persia one a bit more recently. So what they do is they basically package a lot of retro games together with documentary footage, you know, stuff from the archives, could be like, you know, game development notes, blueprints, basically, you know, any graphics from the game, maybe your new stuff. So these are real celebrations of a certain company, or in this case, an individual. So coming out next week on March the 13th, they're going to be releasing LlamaSoft, The Jeff Minter Story. So this is basically, they're calling this the most exhaustive look yet at the life and library of the legendary British developer. So are you excited about this, Enravix? I know you're a big Jeff Minter fan like I am.
Yeah. I think I might get this actually, because, you know, a lot of these titles are on different systems and systems that aren't available, like the Konix multi-system as well, which is something we can talk about. But this is great because it's a full exploration. And I love, like, you know, the Humble Bundles and stuff that you used to get with like collections of games. But this looks a hell of a lot more kind of developed than that. And it's, you know, they've got like interviews with Jeff as well. They've got like extra chapters in there, hidden footage. I just need to get a modern console to play it on, but I assume it's also going to be available for Steam.
Yeah, well, I think the Atari 50 came out on Steam, didn't it? So I've got a feeling it probably will be. And there is 42 Jeff Minter games included here from, you know, his earlier stuff on the ZX81 and the VIC-20 through the Spectrum, C64, Atari 800 in the Jaguar as well. You've got stuff like, you know, Grid Runners on there, Attack of the Mutant Camels, Tempest 2000, Llamatron, Sheep in Space, Hover Bover, that lawnmower game that he did as well, Revenge of the Mutant Camels. Obviously, all his big games are on here as well. But he did touch on something very interesting there, that for the first time, we're going to get to play the Konix multi-system. Now, I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with what the multi-system was, but we...
I can do a good impression now of the advert. Konix!
That is spot on, actually. A lot of people might have seen this. I mean, it was basically a British system that was cancelled back in the very early 90s. And it was meant to be a... It was a bit all-in-one, wasn't it? It was like a steering wheel and had motorbike handles on there.
And a mental chair as well.
I was literally about to say, is this the one which had the mental chair? Like, yeah. You'd like attach everything to it, like a multi-system. Funny that.
Yeah, I'm going to play a racing game. Let's put the steering wheel on, right? I need some force feedback. Yeah, I mean, it was very, very adventurous, I'd say. And then, you know, it was almost about to be released because, like Ravi did an impression there, there was a TV advert made for it and everything that, you know, they're putting on video.
I know Mev Dink was developing, I think it was Last Ninja as well. There were like all custom versions coming out, and Jeff Minter was one of the big developers at the time.
Yeah, and that interview we did with Jeff, not only in the book, but also we had him on the podcast a couple of years ago as well. We went into that with him as well. Because the company that they're doing the technology for it was Flare Technology, which a lot of those guys came out of Sinclair, and they'd also go on to make the Atari Jaguar. So really, you know, you could say the Konix was kind of the precursor to the Jaguar, if you like. But again, like a lot of companies then, you know, Konix had some big financial problems. Turned out the system got cancelled as well. But the interesting thing is that Jeff was working on a game that was previewed in some magazines at the time, and this was at Llamasoft's Attack of the Mutant Camels 89. And it turns out now that the game has been finished, and 34 years after the Konix multi-system was officially cancelled, and even though, you know, no one really knows if there's a full working system anywhere, I've got a feeling Jeff said he might have had like something in his garage, he wasn't sure, but they're actually emulating the Konix multi-system, and you're going to be able to play Attack of the Mutant Camels 89, this game that was previewed in magazines 34 years ago, finally on your modern machine.
For a fan, that's worth it alone, you know.
God, yeah.
And the fact you're getting all these other titles, and I've just noticed Heart of Neon as well, which is just a fantastic documentary, is going to be on there, and two of his light synthesizers as well, Psychedelia and Colorscape, which was another kind of area that Jeff was famous for.
Yeah, I mean, he did the virtual light machine on the Atari Jaguar. So basically, you put an audio CD into the
Trippertron as well was another one, yeah.
Even the Xbox 360 did the virtual light machine on there, didn't he? If you ever listened to an audio CD on the 360, those kind of trippy visuals you got were, you know, Jeff Minter's work. So it is incredible to see a celebration of Jeff's work all in one place. And I think this format, I mean, I'd love to see more of these coming out. So I think they work really well.
If, you know, it's watching great,
you watch a more traditional, like, you know, documentary on a Blu-ray, many of which I love, but often I'm like, oh, I didn't know about that game. Oh, I want to play that game again. And, you know, I'll go and download it or find a way to play it. But actually having them all kind of bundled together so you can hear about a game, come out the documentary, play it for like 10, 15 minutes, go and watch the next part of it. I think that interactive experience is just really, really good for, you know, game preservation and the history of it. So hopefully we'll see more of these from Digital Eclipse. If you want to get hold of that, Llamasoft, the Jeff Minter story, coming to Steam. It is on Steam, Ravi. PS5, PS4, Switch, and Xbox as well, from next week.
And the price-wise, like looking at the Atari 50, you know, that was £30.99. And for the amount of games you're getting on there and stuff, I wonder how much this one's going to cost. But I've already, you know, added it to my wish list.
Yeah, I've got no word on pricing yet, but generally they're around that kind of price. I think the Atari 50 on the PS5 was about 45, 50 quid. It's a pretty standard, you know, new release price on a system. So, but I, you know, even with those, you wait a couple of months, they're generally around 25 quid. You know, but I would encourage anyone that wants it to go and get it on day one, though, because I want to see more of this kind of thing. So that is out on March 13th. I'll put the articles and the links in the show notes if you want to check those out. Now, this is very cool. We love talking about lost prototypes and the weird ways in which they were discovered. Turns out that someone has found a prototype of Time Splitters 4 on a PlayStation 3 dev kit.
Oh, man, I'm so excited for this one. So, yeah, it is exactly what you've just said. Somebody has found a prototype of Time Splitters 4 on a PlayStation 3 development kit. So this has been posted on Reddit by a user known as Lukai, and he shared a couple of photos, the initial photo being just the Time Splitters 4 logo, with a save date on there, which is the 11th of July, 2008. And how the story goes is he's bought this dev kit off eBay and he spotted it on eBay, you know, just, you know, trawling, looking for retro consoles, etc. And he saw somebody was selling for £500 a PlayStation 3 dev kit, which had come from Free Radical. So to kind of like test the legitimacy of it, he messaged the seller and was just a bit like, well, what's the story here? And he said, well, I had a friend who worked at Free Radical and he left in November 2008, which is a month before the studio got shut down. And obviously he had all his development kits and stuff still. And, you know, this particular seller had ended up with them and sold them. So it's been bought. And yeah, there is a fully playable prototype of Time Splitters 4 on there.
So let me just, as someone who's not all that familiar with the Time Splitters series, what is it about number 4 then? Was this kind of a game that was never finished? What kind of happened?
It just never came out. It was never finished. It's been rumoured for years, Time Splitters 4 has. So we got Time Splitters 1, 2 and 3 on the PS2, and 2 and 3 were on like Xbox and GameCube, etc. as well. And right. Then it was always, you know, it was a big series. It was always Time Splitters 4 would come out. It was in development and it's kind of been in development hell because obviously it got revived. When was it last year?
Was another one that was going to be Time Splitters next. So yes. I think they'd put Time Splitters 4 aside.
Yes.
And went on to Time Splitters next. Then Embracer Group took over, I think, Free Radical, cancelled the studios. All this was going on in Nottingham.
All happened in Nottingham, funny enough. But the next Time Splitters has just been in development hell since like 2007, 2008, hasn't it, Ravi?
You know, it almost sounds like Duke Nukem Forever kind of timescales. Well,
they've just actually leaked some footage of Time Splitters next as well.
There we go.
And it does look really cool, actually, where they got it, you know.
So what he's done is he's posted some screenshots of just one of the levels, which looks like a campaign level, around a kind of like a haunted castle, stormy castle from the outside. And the graphics look really nice. And it's a, you know, it's raining and he's got some sort of huge time gun, something you'd probably see on Call of Duty Zombies, like, you know, with like a stopwatch on the side of it and stuff. And David Doak, who obviously famously worked at Free Radical and, you know, worked on Rare before that.
Dr. Doak,
he has legitimized this. He has said, yep, that's they were the levels we were working on, and it all looks credible. I recognize these levels, absolutely. So what Lukai has said is he doesn't know how to dump, you know, from a HD drive or anything like that, but he's going to reach out, and if anybody wants to help him, he will put it online. So I'm sure somebody is probably already helping him.
Yeah.
And it will be there for us all to play the prototype of Time Splitters 4. And as Ravi's just said, I'm sure we'll probably all get the newer version, Time Splitters next.
Yeah, it's disappointing, man, because I absolutely love Free Radical. They're amazing guys. And, you know, it's been just really tough getting a new Time Splitters game out there. And I think everybody wants it, you know. But yeah, it's a story of frustration, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm very pleased that this has been found and preserved, because it's always the weirdest ways, isn't it? You basically said he found this dev kit for £525 and then has happened to find this sitting on the hard disk of it. So the fact that, you know, you imagine, like you said, the studio's closing down, equipment gets sold on. You know, often they do like company auctions where people buy stuff. Not everyone wipes the hard disks if the employees have been let go. So it is very, very cool when these are kind of rescued, I think, you know, rather than just being wiped and lost to history. And like you said, I'm sure, because there is such a passionate community around Time Splitters, there'll be people helping him out already to dump this. You know, this will be online 100%. Before we know, I'm sure. Kind of how finished it is will be interesting to see. So do you know how far along they got with the game before it was pulled?
It doesn't say. So obviously this is a July build and the company got, you know, was done by the December.
Right.
So I can't imagine they got much more done, but we have a first level on there by the looks of things. So, I mean, it'd be incredible if there was like an entire campaign or, you know, multiplayer and everything.
Well, the fans could rebuild it up.
Like, yeah.
But
yeah,
I'm not sure if, you know, there's assets as well, who owns them now and which company could, you know, stamp down on it.
Yeah, true.
Very cool. That's out there, though. Hopefully we'll get a chance to play it soon. So if you want to check that out and all of the retro gaming stories that we talked about on the podcast this week, you don't have to Google around. I'll save you the job. Open your podcast app. The notes are all in there, or you can head to the website and click through from theretrohour.com. Right then, patrons, stay tuned. We have got a couple of exclusive news stories just for our patrons, because we chop all the adverts out of the patrons' version of the podcast, so we don't want to give you a shorter show. Instead, you get a couple more stories. They're on the way. And, of course, this week's special guest, the father of internet radio, Carl Malamud, is coming up in just a second. Before we do that, let's take a second to give a massive thank you to a regular sponsor of our little podcast. That is our friends at ExpressVPN. Now, it does seem to be a bone of contention. I've seen these articles everywhere. Whenever you go on Facebook or anything like that, you know, always the headlines, isn't it? You know, Netflix are putting the price up again. Price hike on Disney Plus. It's all over the place. And you think about how much money collectively you spend. I've tried to work this out before, because I remember us kind of cancelling.
I don't want to work it out.
I'm the same. I cancelled Virgin Media, you know, the cable service. I thought it's getting too expensive. There was that big movement a few years ago, cord cutting, they called it, didn't they?
Where it would be cheaper. It's kind of like, you know, when they promised the paperless office when computers came. It's like, it doesn't happen, you know.
No, I mean, I'd say, you know, the amount of services we subscribe to, my missus does, you know, without me knowing half the time, probably over £100 a month easily on streaming services. You add them all up, you know, Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you think about them all. But using ExpressVPN, you can get value for your money here, because, you know, you think of services like Netflix, for example. Did you know that they've got literally thousands more shows than you can normally see? Because Netflix have got, I think it's around 90 different libraries around the world. So whichever country you go in, you'll see different shows. So if you open Netflix here in the UK, for example, totally different to what someone in America or Italy or Australia sees. But using our sponsor, ExpressVPN, you can basically really easily, just through the click of a button, change your online location. ExpressVPN have got, you know, over 90 countries that you can choose from. So every time you run out of things to watch, you can then switch to another country and unlock an entirely new library of shows and movies. And this is something I know you're doing all the time, Ravi. You always tell us about, you know, random things that you're watching on different Netflix libraries around the world.
Well, it's not just shows. It's also movies. So, you know, movies have certain rights in certain regions. And there's also stuff like movie series as well. So you'll be able to see, you know, part one of The Godfather in one region or part two in another. But what I've been checking out is, of course, Quentin Tarantino's classic Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
On Netflix Canada, actually. And Twin Peaks as well, which is just one of the most trippy series. Absolutely classic. Love that. And that kind of NTSC soap opera drama vibe on Netflix USA. And also Forrest Gump, classic one, really long film actually, on the French Netflix.
Did you cry at the end? Come on, don't lie.
I always cry at Forrest Gump and Back to the Future.
Obviously. Back to the Future, interesting. But that's the thing about ExpressVPN. Tap of a button, change your country, an entire new library of shows, movies that you didn't know you had access to before. And you can even get discounts as well. Now, this is just between us. But you know that some services cost less in other countries. For example, if you subscribe to Netflix from Argentina, it is a fraction of the price from here in the UK. So no, you didn't hear that from us just out there. And ExpressVPN pays for itself and so much more as well, at less than $7 a month. So it is a no-brainer to try ExpressVPN. And actually, if you want to give it a go, why don't you use our exclusive link? You help out the podcast. And also, you'll get 3 months free on top of a one-year plan as well. So go to expressvpn.com/retro. expressvpn.com/retro. I'll put that in our show notes as well so you can check it out. And a big thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support of the show. Right then, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's show. And keep it here. Ravi and I love these kind of really techie interviews. As today we talk to a fascinating guest, the father of internet radio and podcasting as well, let's be honest. Carl Malamud, our special guest. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And today's guest is actually a real internet pioneer, and actually, he's kind of doing what we do now, over 30 years ago, the very first internet broadcasting radio station, which was called Internet Talk Radio, and also was behind the Internet 1996 World Exhibition, which showcased the internet's potential as a global stage for information and culture. So it's going to be incredible to hear some of his memories and how this whole internet radio revolution began with our guest this week, Carl Malamud. How's it going, Carl?
Oh, pretty good, pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and turning, you know, the mic around on you, because I know you did lots of interviews on that Internet Talk Radio back in the day. So it's going to be interesting to kind of hear it from your perspective. But one thing we always like to do with our guests is get a bit of background on their interest in technology, because I know before you did internet radio, you wrote books about computers, you were a journalist as well. So what initially got you interested in computers? Where did your interest in them begin?
It began when I was real little. My father was ran the main ring at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, a physics laboratory like CERN in Geneva. In fact, I spent the first 4 or 5 years of my life in Geneva and Lausanne because my father was working at CERN. And then when he was building Fermilab, those old early PDP computers didn't boot themselves up until you flipped a bunch of switches, and then it got smart enough to read the paper tape. And so one of my jobs on Saturdays is my father would bring me out to the lab and I'd teach the PDP how to boot itself up. So I was using technology pretty early. This was late 60s when I started using them. And then I got interested in I was studying economics at Indiana University. I was doing a PhD in economics, and I was interested in the IBM antitrust suit and the AT&T divestiture. This is when AT&T got broken up into lots of little telephone companies. And I figured if I was doing that for my doctoral work, I should probably know a little bit more about computers, and started working for the Computing Center, ended up dropping out of my PhD program, and there you go. Been doing computers ever since.
So when did you get a home system and a micro, as it was called back there, and what were you kind of doing with it?
Well, so like early 80s, in fact, late 70s, I was using, teletypes that were talking to PDP computers over modems. And, modems were not quite yet going at 300 baud. They were still slower. And then I, at Indiana University, we had mini computers. We had VAXs and primes and things like that. And they were also time sharing systems.
Terminals, were they connected?
Yeah, they were basically terminals on a multi-user system. And a lot of those weren't being used when I went to work for the Computing Center, because the mainframe people were mainframe programmers and they didn't quite trust these mini computers. And so there were several VAXs that really weren't being used. And I started to give every student in the business school at IU, for example, a free account on the VAX. And they could use that to do various projects in their coursework. A lot of them were studying for MBAs, Master of Business Administration. And so I began dealing with users on a regular basis. And it was different from the kind of the mainframe culture where you walked in at 3 a.m. to the card reader, and because that was the only time you could get access to it. And you'd run your cards through and, wait 30 minutes until your program finished. With the mini computers, you could actually type something and see it on the screen on a cathode ray tube.
Well, where did your interest in audio and radio come from? Were you interested in radio at this time or doing anything in it before you got on?
Yeah, I was a music guy. Like until I was 20 years old, that's all I did. So I went to the Interlochen Arts Academy for my senior year of high school, which is a arts program up in Michigan, a residential school, and as part of that, I was program director of the radio station, and I majored in trumpet. But what I learned is where I came from, I was always the very best trumpet player. I was always first chair, and I got to Interlochen, and I barely made the jazz band. I didn't make the orchestra. These people were good, and so when I went to college, I decided I better keep doing my music, but should probably also pull up some additional job skills. So that's how I ended up studying economics and then ended up doing computing.
Did you learn much about radio and its kind of technology and how it related to computing as well?
Not in high school, no. This was late. I graduated in 1976. And so I learned how to read news. I learned how to work the board, did that kind of stuff. But
the kind of operational side of it.
Yeah, it was operational. It was mostly, so it was a low power FM thing, and, you know, it was a lot of music for, you know, the kids on campus. And then, you know, we had news and various other things that were there. But I didn't really learn about the computer side of audio till I started internet talk radio. And that was in like late 92. I started working on that and got one hell of an education.
I bet. I mean, before that, you did touch earlier on, modems. You mentioned the 300 baud modems there. What about kind of personally? When did you first get online, and were you ingrained in that early online world? Were you using stuff like bulletin boards at that stage?
Oh, yeah. Because when I was at Indiana University, one of the things I did is I worked with others to get us connected to the internet. And then after I left the IU Computing Center, I ended up in Washington, D.C., and I worked for the Federal Reserve Board for a year and then became a consultant. And then as part of that, I built my own PC, ordered a board from Taiwan and ordered a case and a power supply and added some of the Unix tools that were available. This is all, you know, DOS 3.0, 3.1, or actually I think it was even earlier than that. But as part of that, I connected my PC up to Usenet and UUCP. So I was able to start sending email to people because I had done that when I was at the IU, computing center. So when I was off on my own, I kind of knew these things already existed. And so I kind of hooked myself up, and that let me send email, which was like a big deal.
And when did you kind of have the vision of creating a internet radio station? Where did it come from?
Oh, well, it came from a couple of things. I was, like in 1991, 92, I traveled around the world, a half dozen times and wrote a book called Exploring the Internet about the internet, starting to grow and turn into something real. It was a technical travelogue is what I called it. It's online. You can download it and read it for free. But as part of that, I was involved in the Internet Engineering Task Force. I was really learning about the internet protocols. I had written a book about TCP/IP protocols. And as part of that, I read every RFC because I had to write about them in a book. And in the Internet Engineering Task Force, they were beginning to experiment with audio. And it was actually live streaming. It was really low bandwidth. Low bit rate, not very good audio, but the idea was allowing people in remote locations to participate in the Internet Engineering Task Force meetings. And not only did we do audio, but we were doing video. And it was, little bitty images, right? We're talking 240 pixels wide for the whole video frame and four frames per second. Whereas today, you're looking at 30 frames a second or overdrive and, 60 frames a second, and you're looking at high definition, even like on YouTube, it works. But in those days, that's all we had. But it was interesting to see these meetings starting to have remote participants. And one day I was just trying to figure out what to do after having written that book, Exploring the Internet. I was at an IETF meeting and I thought to myself, I could do an interview with people, and rather than trying to do it live, why don't we pre-record it and let people download it, right? Because then you could actually have 8-bit audio instead of 4-bit. And it seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And so I went up to a bunch of people I knew, like Vince Cerf and others, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to do a radio show. What do you think?" And they're all like, "Hey, this is great." So that's how Geek of the Week was born.
I was wondering, had you witnessed any of the gigs that happened? Because I know there was some like live streaming and multicasting back in the days with M-Bone technology as well.
Multicasting was kind of going to be the way forward. In fact, the name of my nonprofit was called the Internet Multicasting Service. And I knew about, there were a couple one-off concerts and things that had happened on the internet, which were cool. And I was aware of those, but I was thinking more in terms of actually starting a real radio station. And my insight was that live streaming was good, but that was really hard to do when it was small audience. And so in addition to live streaming stuff, make sure you've got a recorded file online that's available. And so before I started the Internet Multicasting Service, I took another round the world trip and I stopped by Amsterdam and Tokyo, and I talked to my friend Rick Adams, who ran UUNet, one of the first big ISPs. And I said, look, I'm starting this radio station. Can I have FTP space on your central servers? And what I'll do is we'll produce a program, and then we'll upload the program, and then people will go to you and they'll download the program from you. I also wanted to kind of socialize what I was doing, because these were considered to be really big files. A half hour of audio was 30 megabytes. And that was like being really piggish with the internet. It was kind of a scarce resource, right? We're talking, you know, international lines running at T1 speeds, 1.5 million bits per second. And so if you were using substantial bandwidth, you kind of owed it to the rest of the community to let them know what you were doing. And in fact, if you did live streaming, etiquette in those days was you went on the IETF list and you said, hey, everybody, I'm going to be doing live streaming next Tuesday. And someone would go, oh, no, I'm already doing live streaming next Tuesday. You can't do it. And you kind of had to like give people advance notice that this was going to happen. And in fact, when we put the floor of the U.S. House and Senate online for live streaming, it was just an 8 kilobit audio stream. It wasn't that big. I got flamed by a bunch of people saying, look, Carl, if you put the U.S. Congress online for live streaming, pretty soon every parliament in the world's going to want to be on the internet. And there's just not enough bandwidth to be doing that. And luckily, Vince Cerf kind of chimed in and said, well, I don't know if that would be a bad thing.
I actually heard that, yeah, some of those early gigs as well, they would take up, you know, quite a lot of bandwidth, and it would really, really, you know, slow things down when they were performing. I think they were doing a few from Xerox PARC as well.
Oh, severe tire damage, weren't they, the group? Yeah.
No, absolutely. You had to rent the internet those days. Not rent as in pay money, but you had to reserve your bandwidth. And if you didn't, you'd get flamed by people saying, you know, all the international bandwidth being used by your silly rock and roll concert or your IETF meeting or whatever it was you were doing. So you kind of had to reserve that. That's something we don't really have to do these days anymore.
And around this stage, I mean, this was before technologies like MP3. Were even around. So I'm interested in the process of how you recorded the programs and how did you digitize them for distribution?
Oh, well, that was MP3 wasn't there. So we settled on the Sun.au format. It was an 8-bit audio format. We actually recorded on DAT decks. So we were doing 44, you know, kilohertz recording. And there was a sound conversion program in those days called SOX, S-O-X. And it was written by a guy I knew who was working at the Mathematics Institute in the Netherlands, a guy named Guido van Rossum, who went on and developed the Python programming language. But in those days, what he was doing was this sound, you know, exchange program. But it didn't support 44.1 and 48 kilohertz. And so I hacked SOX to add that capability. It's just a matter of changing a parameter, so it sampled at a higher rate. But so we started with full fidelity DAT recording, and then we downsized it to .au files so that it would fit into like 30 megabytes for a half hour program, and that was about as big as you could get away with in those days.
I was also wondering, like, what were your considerations for people with different sound cards and different setups? Because, you know, everything wasn't standardized back then.
Well, that was the deal. When you said, hey, I'm doing a radio program on the internet, the FAQ began with, okay, go get a sound card and install it. And, you know, if you were on a DOS platform, you know, you had, you know, different drivers, and on a Unix platform, and you really had to go get the device drivers and get it so it could talk to the sound card. It wasn't a totally trivial thing. A few years later, you know, sound cards just started being built into every PC that was sold. But in those days, you had to go buy one. You also had to, like, download the TCP/IP software from a place like a bulletin board or get it on a floppy disk because your computer wasn't going to be able to talk to the modem and negotiate the TCP/IP protocol. So you had to install internet as well as a sound card to play in this game. So a lot of our listeners were people that had, like, Sun workstations. Right, or the kind of higher end workstations that you'd expect to see in a research lab like Xerox or at a university. There were a few people using the PCs. There was one guy that actually didn't really have internet, but MCI Mail had an FTP gateway, And what it would do is it would break up the 30 megabytes into 200 individual MCI messages and send them to you. And then when you got all the messages, you would reassemble your audio file. And this is how he listened to Geek of the Week every week.
That's awesome. I mean, obviously, you're the first person doing this. There was kind of no template either. And you think of traditional radio before that. I mean, it was all, you know, soundproof studios and expensive complexes. What was kind of your setup in those early days of internet talk radio? Did you have a studio? How many PCs did you have? How did it kind of work behind the scenes?
Well, we actually, I began in my house out in Virginia, but we very quickly after I started it, we rented a studio in the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., and we soundproofed the studio. So we had nice Mackie mixing boards, and we had DAT recording discs, and we had real microphones and headphones. And, I mean, we actually built a real studio in there. And because we were in the National Press Building, I kind of wandered upstairs to the National Press Club where they had all their luncheons. And they had people like the Dalai Lama and Al Gore and Larry King, you know, would come in and do a 1 hour luncheon speech. And they had broadcast booths, and one was occupied by National Public Radio and one was occupied by C-SPAN, and the third one was empty. And so I said, hey, could I have that broadcast booth? And in return, I actually put the National Press Club up on the internet. I ran a cable from my studio up to the 13th floor and got them online. I happened to own press.org, and so I gave them a domain name and built them a website. So it was a nice fair trade. But as part of that, I was able to record all the luncheons. And at first, we just recorded them and then FTP'd them up. And about a year later, we started live streaming all the luncheons out.
That's pretty amazing. I was wondering, did you have those DATs still and, have them in the higher quality?
The DATs are, I think, in my basement at this point. At one point, we were going to go back and rescue the masters, and I think I've still got them. But, you know, the AU files actually sound remarkably good because we engineered our patches on the sound, the compression and the EQ and all that. We kind of optimized it for AM radio because that was the level of sound quality we had available to us. And they come out nice and clean. I mean, they sound old-fashioned, but they still sound good. So I'm happy with the AU files, and we obviously converted those to MPEG-3 as well, and they're all up on the Internet Archive.
I was wondering how you marketed the station then in those early days and get the word out.
Oh, that was easy. You send email to the Internet Engineering Task Force list, and there was one other big list called Compriv, and said, hey, everybody, I'm doing a radio program. And so each week I'd send out a kind of a form email saying, you know, on this week for Geek of the Week, we're interviewing Tim Berners-Lee or Steve Deering, the guy who did IPv6 and multicasting, was actually his PhD dissertation. And so they were pretty in-depth, technical interviews. But since we were in the National Press Building anyway, we added the luncheons. I put a satellite dish on the roof of the National Press Building, and we joined the public radio satellite system. So I was able to get syndication rights to Tech Nation, for example, which is a great talk show that still runs. And so we put all those programs online, and then we started helping out places like the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And we went in there and, recorded some of their performances, did some interactive things. Digital cameras were just starting to happen then. So we had our digital cameras to take pictures of things. And so we did original productions as well as, the podcast Geek of the Week. And of course, in those days, it wasn't called a podcast. That was something that came along later, and podcasting is specific to RSS syndication and MPEG-3 files. But
getting people participating kind of a harder sell than, selling the already informed geeks a radio show, convincing them we can put you on the internet,
I didn't worry about that. We didn't care how many people were listening. It was a few hundred people a week were listening to the podcasts and the other programs. They took off. We did a deal with HarperCollins in which they gave us rights to a bunch of cassette tapes they had called Harper Audio. And it was people like T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost reading their own poems and a wonderful collection. So we put those online and people just discovered them. We didn't worry about numbers. In fact, when we first did live streaming, this was funny. The Associated Press sent a reporter in and we were live streaming Al Gore, I think. And I was down in the studio looking at my son workstation, you know, because this was going out live and the reporter's right behind me. And he goes, can you tell how many people are listening right now? And I looked at it and I said, six. And you could see his face fall. He's like, really? That's it? And I said, yeah, there's six people, but they're on four different continents. At which point I think I got his attention.
There were big numbers back then, though, I guess. You know, like you said, it was
well, four different continents. I mean, yeah. that was something that, you know, radio stations were limited to where their radio waves would go. Mm. And my radio station reached all over the world. So, I mean, that was different than what you were used to with radio. That got the reporter's attention.
Yeah, it's interesting to think as well about the kind of lineup that you had on Internet Talk Radio, because it sounds like you had quite a diverse schedule of programming there, different programs that you're putting out. So how did you decide on the content for the station? What was kind of your vision for the type of programming and the type of audience that you wanted to attract?
Well, I made it a public radio station. When we first launched, it's funny, we made front page of the New York Times above the fold. I mean, it was the headline, you know, move over Ted Turner. And my phone just rang off the hook because, you know, you make front page of the New York Times, you get a lot of random phone calls coming in. But one of them was like Nicholas Negroponte. And Nick called up and he said, Nicholas Negroponte, I'm director of the MIT Media Lab. Can you send me your business plan? And at the time, I hadn't thought of like the business plan. It was just we're going to do a radio station. And so I thought about it real hard. And I called Nick back a couple days later and said, Nick, I've decided to make this a public radio station. I think it's too early to be bringing in, you know, dot-com money to, you know, and my worry was that the medium was early enough that I knew we were going to want to change directions periodically and maybe do a World's Fair on the internet. We ended up doing that in 1996. We ended up putting the Securities and Exchange Commission EDGAR database online. And my worry was that if we were a dot-com radio station, right, trying to make it a business, that our investors just wouldn't understand if we came in and said, well, listen, we're going to make a slight diversion here and, you know, get into the database business because we think that's important to do. Mm. And so I told Nick, and I'm making it a public radio station. And he was kind of disgusted with me because he thought there was commercial potential there. But I thought I am a big fan of public radio, public TV. And so our content was kind of oriented around that, you know, that frame of mind. But the basic answer on how we chose programming is we took what we could get, right? I mean, you know, I saw HarperCollins had a bunch of cassette tapes they were selling, and I called them up, and you had to explain what the internet was, and they were like, okay, I don't see any harm in this. And so they sent me a box of cassette tapes, and we digitized them. Public radio satellite system. There were a couple programs out there that had me on as a guest, and I called Maura Marks up for Tech Nation and said, hey, you know, can I syndicate your program? And she was like, sure. Press Club, we happened to be in the press building, so we did the National Press Club. So you took what you could get. We were small. There were, you know, half dozen of us max, and, you know, more like three people. So Marty Lucas was our audio producer, and my friend Luther Brown was our program director. Luther had been a producer for Tom Brokaw and NBC News.
Right.
And ended up working with me on the early days of Internet Talk Radio. It wasn't a huge operation. There were like, you know, there were maybe six of us, and that included running large government databases and other things that we did besides the audio programming.
It's interesting to hear that you ran it as a, you know, basically a non-profit corporation. Because I know you did have contributions from some parts of the tech sector. I believe Sun Microsystems contributed towards the running of it, didn't they? I mean, yeah. How did you fund its running then? I mean, did you get much contributions from the tech industry?
No. Well, we got some. Sun Microsystems was great. Eric Schmidt was at Sun in those days, and so he gave me computers, and I knew their networking guys because I had written a book about, you know, Sun TCP IP and, you know, Sun NFS and the other, you know, network protocols. So I knew the folks at Sun. I knew Tim O'Reilly at O'Reilly Media, and he thought it was an interesting experiment. And so both Sun and O'Reilly gave me a little bit of cash to get things started. Sun gave me equipment. But, you know, at the end of the day, we really weren't getting a lot of, you know, donation money coming in. And, you know, by end of 96, I was unable to bring in enough funding. And so we basically stopped doing the internet multicasting service then. And you know, at that time, the dot-com thing was just starting to explode. And you just couldn't get charitable contributions for a public radio station on the internet. you couldn't get charitable contributions for, you know, things like the Bind software. I chaired the Internet Systems Consortium, and they produce Bind, which is the software that the domain name system runs on you know, any Unix platform is Bind-based. Getting that funded was hard. You know, the days of that first nonprofit was maybe a four-year time span on that. And, well, and then I didn't give up. So what I did is in 2007, I started my current nonprofit called Public Resource. And I've been running that ever since. So I like operating in the nonprofit world. I think there's more space to do creative things and more space to do things that are good for the world as opposed to good for the bottom line.
Your program Geek of the Week was a very innovative show. Where did the idea come from? And I was wondering, did you have any influence from the magazine culture at the time?
Oh, a little bit. I mean, I had been writing for you know, trade press for a long time. I'd written for InfoWorld, and I was a weekly columnist for Communications Week and monthly columnist for Data Communications. So I was familiar with the zines that are out there and had looked at them. I mean, the reason I did Geek of the Week is my talent pool was the Internet Engineering Task Force. And my basic modus was I would go to an IETF meeting with a DAT deck and a microphone, and I'd corral as many of my friends as I could and say, hey, why don't you come up to the hotel room and I want to record an interview with you. So that's how we came up with Geek of the Week.
And I guess that was the ideal kind of subject for your audience as well.
Yeah, in fact, one of our taglines later on when we added other kinds of programming was, finally, the medium isn't the message. Because, you know, Geek of the Week was all about the Internet. But again, that was the talent pool. It was the people that it was my colleagues and my peers, the people that were helping develop Internet protocols. And for, you know, a half dozen years, going to IETF meetings was a big part of my life.
And it is incredible looking back. I mean, obviously, the whole archive is available on archive.org, which I'll link up in the show notes. And I was going through the archives of Geek of the Week over the weekend. And the first one that jumped out to me was seeing your interview with Tim Berners-Lee in 1993. And I mean, you know, the World Wide Web was hardly out the door of, you know, basically being an alpha product at CERN at that stage. You know what I mean? It was very early. And so many other internet pioneers as well. So in terms of a time capsule looking back at that time, I mean, you really captured some really exciting moments in internet development. I mean, are there any memorable interviews or moments that stand out to you? And maybe if you've listened back in more recent years, anything that kind of stood out to you listening back?
Oh, I don't know. But, you know, so the World Wide Web, when we started putting the U.S. Patent Database and Securities and Exchange Commission databases online, the web existed, but I was very skeptical of it. Tim had showed it to me when I visited him in CERN, like in 91, 92, I think. He gave me a demo. It was on a Next workstation. And my reaction was, yeah, this is interesting, but I don't think it'll scale. And I actually left it out of my book, Exploring the Internet, because I didn't think it was an internet thing. I thought it was a LAN thing, right? Because he showed it to me on a fancy Next workstation with fancy graphics and things like that. But obviously I was wrong. But when we first started doing the databases, we didn't do it on a web server. We did an FTP server. We had a Waves database, so we had full text search, and we used Gopher. And it was only about a year later that I said, yeah, we should probably do this web thing. And so we brought in HTTPD and got it up and running and started offering it on the World Wide Web. But again, I was skeptical when I first saw the web. I just didn't see how it could possibly scale to a global level, which shows you never to listen to people that think they're experts.
Oh, did the audience give you much feedback? I was wondering, did you receive physical stuff as well as, you know, email?
Oh, well, no, audience email is what you got. I got some letters occasionally, you know, snail mail, but no, it was mostly email, and it was mostly on the mailing lists, right? The IETF list and Compriv and the various other lists that were there, and that's where the feedback would come in. You know, and usually the feedback wasn't about the radio thing. It was more about the content of the podcast, about people, you know, like arguing about whether IP version 6 was going to like work or not, you know, issues like that.
Anyone who thinks that flame wars are a recent thing with social media, let's go back to those Usenet archives back in the early 90s or the 80s. It's always been around.
Oh my. And it was vicious.
Well, you did touch on before the Internet 1996 World Exhibition that you put on, which was a real groundbreaking project, I think. And that kind of, it brought the concept of a world fair into the digital age. So what inspired you to create that? Because, I mean, it was a very ambitious event, particularly something to do online. So tell us kind of how the seeds of that started and how did you bring that to life?
Well, it was online, but also in the real world. So we actually had over 50 countries participating. We had a dozen heads of state endorse it. So, you know, there were letters from Boris Yeltsin and Bill Clinton and, you know, the president of Kyrgyzstan, you know, congratulations on Internet 1996 World Exposition. But it was also in the real world. So, for example, Vince Cerf was an MCI in those days. He convinced MCI and KDD to give us a T3 line across the Pacific to break in a new fiber cable that had been laid between the U.S. and Japan. And that was like a $300 million contribution. That's what, if you had actually tried to get a T3 line in those days, you, that, that's what you'd pay. To do that. But he gave it to us, and we were like the first, for a while, it was the fastest international line on the internet. And then in Japan, there were all sorts of real world street fairs, and in IBM was a big sponsor of it in Japan. In Taiwan, I went there, and the main train station was outfitted with a whole bunch of, you know, banners and PCs and, you know, people standing there saying, can I show you the internet? And they actually had it all over the island in Taiwan. And so they, it was used as a way of rolling out the internet in places like Japan and Taiwan. Thailand was a big participant in it. Netherlands had all sorts of activities. They actually was the headquarters for the World's Fair for a while. And it was a way of showcasing what the internet was, and so it was fun. It was fun. We were able to let loose a little bit. And I had been fascinated by World's Fairs, as that was where a lot of technology rolled itself out, right? In the late 1800s and early 1900s, World's Fairs were where technology was shown to people and where people learned about it. And so it seemed to me that a World's Fair as a metaphor would be a useful one to do. And I was able to draft a bunch of internet folks to work with me on it because they found it useful in their countries. Like Jun Murai, who's the vice president of research at Keio University in Japan, found it a really useful hook to go and see government officials and say, hi, Japan is participating in a World's Fair. We should do something. But, so it was a good way of attracting attention from folks like that and introduce the internet to them.
I was reading as well that the archives of the fair were put onto CD-ROMs and sealed into a physical time capsule. So when can that be opened and how did you plan for future generations to access it? Because, I mean, you know, CD-ROM drives are already a bit scarce in 2024.
So the World's Fair book, which MIT Press published, a full-color coffee table book, had an audio CD in the back that Marty Lucas did the programming on. That was a lot of nice original compositions. And then there was also a CD-ROM in the front that used early Java software as the user interface. The archive was buried in Japan. And I have no idea if they dug it up or what happened to it. What I did do, however, is I took as much of the website as we could, and I made sure to keep that spinning. And it's still there if you go to park.org. It's a little primitive. There were a few organizations that insisted we take down their materials, but as a general rule, we don't like to do that. But it's still up, and you know, it's so you can see the HTML pages and the graphics, which are pretty primitive. But then, you know, the music's still online, and a lot of the press that we got is still there. And my World's Fair book, I got copyright back when it went out of print, so we made that available. And that was kind of fun because, you know, we allowed anyone to be a country for the Internet World's Fair. We just decided we weren't going to get in the business of deciding who was a country or not. So both Tibet and Taiwan just grabbed onto that and said, hey, we're there. we'll do a country pavilion. We actually got a protest from the Chinese government for allowing Taiwan to be a country. And Tibet was very glad to be a country. And so I was able to get the Dalai Lama to write the foreword to the book. And then in 97, I was able to travel to Dharamsala and present him with a copy of the book, which was very cool because I got to spend 30 minutes with him in his private office. And that was quite the experience.
And it's great to hear that it's archived, you know, so people can look back on it as well, because it does seem really groundbreaking for the time. And I mean, going back to internet talk radio, you kind of touched on before that you had to close it down in, I think you said, late 96, which really, I mean, that was around the time that I remember first discovering internet radio. That's kind of when, you know, platforms and, you know, services like Real Audio started to become usable to the everyday person. Did you kind of feel like you were maybe just a little bit too early to the game, and it must have kind of felt a little bit sad to have to close down your station just when it kind of felt the rest of the world was just starting to latch onto it? Did that feel a bit?
Well,
it
was early to the game, which is why I made it a nonprofit rather than a for-profit. You know, I stand by that decision. I got to do a lot of things that if it was a for-profit company, wouldn't have been able to do it. But then, yeah, Rob Glaser came along and did Real Audio. Mark Cuban, you know, did his broadcast.com thing and was able to flip that really quickly to Yahoo for a couple billion dollars. But no, I had no regrets. You know, I wish that the nonprofit could have been funded. And it's something, I mean, we were doing a lot of operational things like these big government databases and things like that. And you know, we thought it was a valuable public part of the internet. But it's always been like that. Funding an operational nonprofit on the internet, like the one I run now, Public Resource, it's always been a challenge. It's always really hard to convince people that some things really should just be public, right? Not patented, not, you know, man in the middle, you know, intermediary gateway. Some things really should be distributed and open and available for everybody to use. And I think there's an important role for that. But it's always been hard to attract foundation funding for that kind of stuff.
Your work's been often credited as a precursor to modern podcasting. Do you see that as an evolution?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I don't mind calling it podcasting. I get flamed by the people that invented podcasting as a term with, again, RSS and MP3. But no, it's been interesting to watch podcasting grow and, you know, become fairly ubiquitous. It's a cool thing.
And I think today, you know, there are so many podcasts that exist on, you know, just on YouTube, for example, and they call those podcasts, and they're not delivered via RSS. So the term does feel like it's changed somewhat. So I think looking back at what you were doing then, it would definitely fit the kind of modern term of podcasting, I think, fall under that umbrella.
Well, somebody came along a few years later and actually got a patent on podcasting. And the EFF used my prior art and other prior art to kind of beat that patent back, but yeah, look, I've never been religious on use of terminology and stuff like that. I think you need to be a little bit flexible as to defining these things. And you need to be a little liberal. I mean, John Postel said be careful on what you send and liberal on what you receive. And I think that applies to ideas as well, right? You know, you should have some discipline in what you're doing, but you should keep an open mind on what other people are doing. Because there was way too much table pounding in the early days on internet standards, particularly like International Standards Organization, you know, had a very set way of doing networking. And, you know, there were two internets in the early days. There was Open Systems Interconnection, which was the official International Standards Organization protocol suite with very expensive standards. I mean, it cost thousands of dollars to buy these things, and they were feature rich. Let's say. And then there was this other internet that a kind of ragtag unincorporated association of a few hundred people around the world put together, the Internet Engineering Task Force. And we weren't supposed to win, right? It was IBM and AT&T and Defense Department all thought OSI was going to be the internet. Mm. And AT&T particularly thought it would be a smart network, right? In which you would, you know, every text you send would cost 20 cents. Right. It was kind of a shopping model of internet services. Ours ended up winning because it was open and distributed. And most importantly, the standards were available for free. So any random person could walk in and come up with a new protocol like Tim Biel did or like, you know, the email folks did. And it's why ours succeeded and the other one didn't. But it wasn't obvious in the late 80s that our version of the internet would actually work.
Yeah, could have gone a very different way, definitely. Yeah. Well, one thing that's a real hot topic in recent years is, you know, particularly with, you know, things like subscription models and, you know, games consoles, for example, a lot of them, you know, rumors that they're going to be losing physical media and everything's going digital now. Digital archiving and the preservation of digital media has become really important to a lot of people. How do you think we should approach the preservation of things like internet history and digital content for future generations. Have you got any thoughts on that? Because I know that's something you've always been passionate about.
Well, my day job at Public Resources, we make the law available, right? We make building codes available for free. We make state legislative codes like the state of Georgia. We just won a huge win in the European Union Court of Justice just now. In which they said that harmonized public safety standards, like safety of toys, are the law in Europe and therefore need to be made available. But increasingly, what's been happening is, so like I was sued by the state of Georgia for putting the official code of Georgia annotated online. And we were sued for copyright violations. It's the law, right? This isn't, you know, any big secrets here. We lost in the district court. We went to the U.S. Court of Appeals and then to the U.S. Supreme Court, and we won. And it's the proposition that edicts of government, which is the law and legal materials issued in the name of the state, don't have copyright in the United States. But despite that win, what Lexis and Georgia have done is they basically have a streaming solution to the law in which, in order to get the official code of Georgia annotated, you have to subscribe to the Lexis Advanced Service. And you can get your law as a service, but you're not able to download the entire code and put it online. And it's ironic because when I won in the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice said that citizens shouldn't be limited to economy class access to the law. They should be upgraded to first class. And despite, you know, this first class upgrade that the Chief Justice gave me, I still can't get the official code of Georgia annotated. Right. And so this is an issue not just for archiving, you know, content from Tumblr or YouTube or on the Internet Archive, archiving the web. It's also a huge situation for, you know, fundamental databases of our democracies, like the laws. So law librarians cannot download official code of Georgia annotated. And it used to be that, you know, a law library in Georgia would have all the previous versions of the official code of Georgia annotated, because sometimes you had to dig back in the stacks to consult those. And with the current systems being put in place, you no longer have that safeguard anymore. You're counting on, you know, a few private players to safeguard history for you. And that's not going to happen, right? That's always, when there's a single point of failure, the failure will occur.
Yeah, and it does feel like, I mean, you know, you kind of touched on the copyright aspect of it there as well. I mean, we had Jason Scott from Internet Archive on. I know you continually see the amount of stories about companies demanding takedowns or suing them. It feels like it's such a minefield, that balance between archiving and treading on copyright. It just feels like there needs to be some way of solving that, but I'm not sure what it is.
Well, I get that all the time because of the stuff that, I mean, we were sued for posting all the building and electrical and fire codes for the United States. And we lost, and we finally ended up winning, but it took 10 years of litigation. And this was for something that everybody agrees is the law, right? And the idea that it should be hidden behind a $1,000, you know, paywall with keep off the grass signs is just nuts. And we get that a lot with some of our other databases that we have online. Now, I tend to focus on, you know, things that everybody, any reasonable person agrees ought to be public, like the law. But even there, that's a huge bone of contention. Like I said, we got sued for posting building codes and fire codes, which is a little bit nuts.
Well, obviously, Geek of the Week shows are all available on archive.org. And listening back to these old shows, they kind of have, you know, the history, the evolution of the internet. But I was wondering, were there any different paths or any kind of big surprises that have happened that you didn't expect to happen?
Well, we thought multicasting was the way audio and video was going to be distributed, right? That there would be a multicast backbone, which, you know, connected different islands together with dedicated lines, or at least, you know, lines with high priority, and that somehow the audio would get distributed that way. And instead, it's all shoved in port 80, you know, HTTP protocol. And so I thought multicasting was going to be the wave of the future, but it turns out it's used. So multicast packets are used on your local area network. It's how your Windows server discovers your printer, for example. They each advertise that, hey, I'm here, and then there's various protocols to connect them together. But it's not a wide area protocol. So that was the biggest surprise to me. The other big surprise is, you know, disk space was a huge deal. When I did the Internet World's Fair, I got it was Western Digital, I believe, gave us 2 terabytes of disk drives. And that was considered, oh my God, infinite amount of space.
I've got that on my keyring now in my on my car keys.
Yeah, yeah, but we got it. We got a whole bunch of disk drives. I forget, 100 meg or 500 meg or 500 gigs. I don't know, but it wasn't big. And so we got boxes and boxes of disk drives, and we flew them around the world to where our various servers were, and that was considered a really big deal. And now, I'm buying 18 terabyte drives and ganging them up. And, I've got a computer that's got 24 disk slots in it, creates a big ZFS array. And so the idea that disk space would be essentially infinite was something that I had read about that was kind of going to happen, but I didn't really believe it. And now I do believe it. And it's totally changed the way I do things, right? I mean, high res now means really high res. Whereas before it meant, well, I don't know, that'd be too big. People might not be able to download it.
Yeah, I mean, we go into YouTube today, if that 1080p option isn't there, I'm like, oh yeah, the quality is not good enough to watch it in 720. But, we're spoiled these days, aren't we, compared to what we had to deal with 30 years ago.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, 4K video is like a real thing. And not only that, things like cameras, used to be really expensive, especially video cameras. My first video camera was a real TV video camera. And it was, I don't know how much it cost, but one of my friends at Sun Microsystems had it and he let me use it. But now, your average iPhone like does the job and does pretty good. And if you want to do high-end video, there's all sorts of tools available that let you do that. That, again, was not on my horizon when I first started doing that.
Well, Carl, it's been incredible to hear your memories of, these pioneering days of internet broadcasting. And if people are interested in finding out a bit more about, publicresource.org, tell us a bit about what you're doing these days and where people can find out more.
Well, so public.resource.org is our website. Although we're all over the Internet Archive, I've probably got 2 million objects up on there. We do 2 things. One is edicts of government, right? The law and making it available. And that's partly showing by doing, but buying the law and scanning it and putting it online. And it's also been a litigation experience. We've had a dozen law firms working for us pro bono. This building codes case, which was 10 years of litigation. We had over $10 million in free legal help on that one because U.S. litigation is so expensive. The other thing we do is I'm making 6 trips to India this year, and I have been doing so for almost 10 years now. We run one of the largest libraries of Indian books online now. We've got over 600,000 books. We're scanning 1.5 million pages every month at our scanning center in Bangalore. We make our own scanners now in India. It's modeled on the Internet Archive tabletop scribe, but it's high end Sony cameras and frames and cradles that let you do non-destructive scanning. And we're really scaling that up significantly in India. So that's one of the big things that we've been doing lately.
Yeah, it's really important work that you're doing. And if people want to check out your website, I'll link that in the show notes as well. Along with the archives of Geek of the Week, because they are really interesting to listen to, through a modern lens, kind of looking back at how those early internet technologies were developing. So I'll link those up as well. And who knows, maybe one day this interview will be in those archives as well for future generations, Carl. So it's nice to have you on the podcast and really appreciate you taking the time to come on and share some of your memories with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.